Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the science report with Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember brings us the latest in the American history series, Making of a Nation. But first, this story with help from Anna Mateo.
Marguerite Cottrell remembers the summer day almost 75 years ago when a note was brought to her family's farm. Her mother opened the note, read it, sat down, and cried. The note informed the family that Cottrell's older brother, John Reynolds, had been killed. He died during the Allied forces' invasion of Nazi-controlled Normandy on the coast of France on June 6, 1944, also known as D-Day. "I knew something bad had happened," Cottrell told the Associated Press. She was 4 years old at the time and remembers her mother telling her, "Well, little Jack has gone to heaven. I don't know what we're going to do." All over the little town of Bedford, Virginia, near the Blue Ridge Mountains, other families received similar messages that summer. Each message opened the same way, expressing the United States Secretary of War's deep regret in informing that a loved one was killed or missing. 20 men from Bedford and the surrounding area were killed on D-Day. 19 died while trying to take control of Omaha Beach from the German Army as members of Company A of the 116th U.S. Infantry Regiment. The 20th death was of a soldier in a different company.
The D-Day invasion was a hugely important event in World War II. It marked a turn in the fighting. The Allied forces, led by Britain, the Soviet Union, France, and the U.S., won the war less than 2 years later. The invasion also had a major effect on Bedford, a small town of about 4,000 people at the time. Its D-Day losses were among the largest of any community in America. Writer Alex Kershaw's 2003 best-selling book, The Bedford Boys, notes that the dead were young men who entered adulthood during the Great Depression. They joined the National Guard before the war to make some extra money. They also sought to wear the uniforms that local girls found appealing, Kershaw wrote. Frank Draper and Elmer Wright were popular local baseball players. Wallace Carter worked at a business where people gathered to play the game of pool. Earl Parker was a newly married man that died before seeing his baby daughter. Brothers Ray and Roy Stevens hoped to farm together after the war, but only Roy survived. Their time in fighting was short. Among the first groups on Omaha Beach, Bedford's sons were killed by Nazi machine guns and explosives within minutes of their arrival on boats. Soldier Elisha Ray Nance is one of the few Bedford boys who survived that day. Local historian James Morrison wrote about Nance's recollection of the experience in Morrison's book, Bedford Goes to War. "They were waiting for us. The minute the ramp went down, they opened up," said Nance, meaning the Germans fired at them immediately.
In 1996, the U.S. Congress established the National D-Day Memorial on an area of land next to Bedford. The memorial honors the more than 4,000 Allied soldiers who lost their lives in the battle. When people come here, it is important to see the town as the monument itself, then-President George W. Bush said at a 2001 ceremony that opened the memorial. This is the place they left behind. History lover Ken Parker and his wife Linda have turned the town's old drugstore into a coffee shop and place of remembrance for the Bedford Boys. Green's Drugstore was where Bedford Boys spent free time as high schoolers. Their wives and girlfriends often went there to exchange news and information during the war. The center is now filled with uniforms, pictures, and other items. This includes the device known as a teletype machine that Parker says printed out the notices when the boys were killed. On a recent Monday, townswoman Mary Ellen Cunningham came in to take a look around. She said seeing the old teletype filled her with strong emotions. "I can't even imagine the operator that was getting one telegram after another," she said.
The Parkers, who recently moved to Bedford from Oklahoma, said they get similar visits all the time from people living in Bedford. People often want to leave a war-related family heirloom for presentation at the new Tribute Center. Elisha Ray Nance, the last surviving Bedford boy, died in 2009. Only a few of the fallen soldiers' brothers and sisters are still alive. But the Parkers said younger generations have held on to many of the boys' letters and other items. They pass the items down through generations almost like holy objects. The Parkers said one of the Bedford boys' relatives recently found a collection of unopened letters his grandmother had sent to her son before she knew he had been killed on D-Day. "They just bottled this up for so long," Linda Parker said. "They can finally open that box and let the stuff out." Marguerite Cottrell recently visited Green's Drugstore. She said her mother used to open an old container of her brother's belongings on Sunday afternoons and read his letters. Cottrell said her mother blamed herself for letting Jack join the military and talked about him often to keep his memory alive. "There's so many people that have passed away, you know, that this would have meant so much to," she said of the drugstore. "My mom would have loved coming here." I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
U.S. officials have approved the costliest medicine in history, a $2.1 million gene therapy that treats a rare childhood disease. Gene therapy is a medical treatment in which healthy genetic material is introduced into cells to replace abnormal genes. The new gene therapy targets a disease called spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA, which severely weakens a child's muscles. The treatment, called Zolgensma, was developed by Swiss drug maker Novartis. Over time, SMA can make it impossible for the child to move, swallow, or breathe. The disease affects about 1 in 10,000 births. In 90% of cases, the condition causes death or the need for permanent breathing assistance by age 2. SMA is the leading cause of genetic infant death. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, recently approved Zolgensma for use in children who are under the age of 2 with SMA. The approval covers babies with the deadliest kind of the disease, as well as those with forms that develop more slowly over time. Novartis says Zolgensma is designed to repair the genetic cause of SMA by replacing a patient's abnormal or missing gene to halt progression of the disease. The one-time treatment can be performed in about an hour. Novartis has defended the high cost of the gene therapy. It says the treatment represents a new kind of transformational medicine that opens the door to future gene therapies. It also said the $2.1 million therapy was about 50% less than other SMA treatments that can be ongoing for years. Novartis said it will let health insurance companies break up the cost in payments of $425,000 over 5 years. It also plans to give money back if the treatment does not work. The FDA said the drug's safety had been tested in completed and ongoing trials involving 36 patients between the ages of 2 weeks and 8 months. Most evidence of the treatment's effectiveness is based on the ongoing trials. In patient testing, babies with the most severe form of SMA who got Zolgensma within 6 months of birth had limited muscle problems. Those who got the treatment very early in life did the best. Babies who were given Zolgensma after 6 months stopped losing muscle control, but the medicine was not able to correct damage already done. The trial found the demonstrated significant improvement in their ability to reach developmental motor milestones. These included head control and the ability to sit without support. The one other medicine for SMA approved in the U.S. is a drug called Spinraza. Instead of a one-time treatment, it must be given every 4 months. The U.S.-based Biogen, Spinraza's maker, charges $750,000 for the first year of treatment, followed by $350,000 per year after that. The independent not-for-profit group Institute for Clinical and Economic Review rates the value of costly new medicines. The group said it considers the price of Zolgensma acceptable because it greatly transforms the lives of families affected by this devastating disease. While it is too early to know how long the effectiveness of the treatment will last, some doctors have hope that it could last a lifetime. Dr. Jerry Mendel is a neurologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. He led one of the early patient studies involving Zolgensma. When asked whether he believes the drug will continue to have long-lasting effects, Mendel told the Associated Press, "It's beginning to look that way." He noted that some of those treated as babies are now 4 or 5 years old with no signs of the disease. I'm Brian Lynn. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue our series of time capsule programs, each one exploring another facet, decade, or period of America in the 20th century. Science brings an end to World War II and lays the groundwork for a new attention to research, development, and scientific education in the years to come. World War II ended with an action that was never taken before in the history of warfare and has never been taken since. It required the efforts of a team of scientists. Working in secrecy, they designed and built the first atomic bombs. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use these weapons against Japan in August of 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
America's use of atomic weapons brought years of conflict in Europe and the Pacific to an end. But it also marked the beginning of the nuclear age. And it represented, in a dramatic way, the growing importance of science and technology in modern times. Interest in science goes back to the earliest days of the nation. President Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were famous not only as political leaders, but also as inventors and scientists. President Abraham Lincoln and Congress established the National Academy of Sciences during the Civil War in the 1860s. And in the early 1900s, the nation created scientific offices to study and improve agriculture, public health, even air travel. By the start of World War I in 1914, the federal government was employing scientists in many areas of work. President Woodrow Wilson created the National Research Council to organize the work of scientists and engineers to win the war. However, before World War II, government support for science was generally limited. The government was willing to pay for research only to meet certain clear goals, such as better weapons or military transport systems. World War II greatly changed the traditionally limited relationship between American scientists and the federal government. In the early years of the war, the German forces of Adolf Hitler showed the world the power of their new tanks, guns, and other weapons. President Franklin Roosevelt knew that the United States would need to develop modern weapons of its own if it entered the war. For this reason, Roosevelt established a National Defense Research Committee in 1940 to support and organize research on weapons. The new committee included some of the top scientists in America. Among its members were the presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Bell Laboratories. The committee did its work so well that Roosevelt later formed an even more powerful Office of Scientific Research and Development. The leader of both groups was Vannevar Bush, no relation to the future presidents. He had long experience as a professor of electrical engineering and as an inventor. Many scientists knew him. Vannevar Bush put together a hard-working team. And in the years that followed, American scientists and engineers developed one invention after another to help the war effort. Scientists developed new devices to help the Navy find German submarines. They improved methods for bombers to find their targets. And they developed more powerful rockets to protect American troops when they landed on foreign beaches. American scientists and doctors also made great progress in improving the methods of wartime medicine. World War II may well have been the first war in history in which a wounded soldier was more likely to survive than to die. But in many ways, the most important scientific development of the period was the atomic bomb. In 1939, Albert Einstein wrote President Roosevelt a letter. The scientist told the president that it might soon be possible to build a powerful weapon, a weapon that would use the power of the atom. And he urged Roosevelt to get American scientists to build the atomic bomb before German scientists could build one. Roosevelt agreed. He created a special team of scientists. Their work became known as the Manhattan Project. Roosevelt made sure that these scientists got all the money and supplies they needed. Roosevelt died before the scientists could complete their work. But in April 1945, the scientists told the new president, Harry Truman, that they were almost ready to test their invention. Just 3 months later, they exploded the world's first atomic bomb in the desert in the southwestern state of New Mexico. Truman had to make a difficult decision. He knew the atomic bomb would cause widespread death and suffering if it was used on a Japanese city. But he was willing to do anything to avoid the need for American troops to invade Japan. In Japan, a new prime minister and government were searching for a way to end the war. But Truman believed that the Japanese were still not ready to surrender, and he felt it was his duty to end the war as soon as possible. On August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb fell on the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second A-bomb fell on the city of Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
President Truman.
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies.
The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 people died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. The bombings left Japan's rulers with no choice. In less than 1 week, they surrendered.
I received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender.
In this newsreel, we hear General MacArthur accepting the surrender of the Japanese Empire.
The battle battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Allied Commander for the occupation of Japan, boards the Missouri. Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Pacific Fleet Commander, and Admiral Halsey welcome MacArthur and his Chief of Staff, General Sutherland, aboard. It is Sunday, September 2nd, 1945.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese imperial forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
American scientists and engineers proved that a war could be won with research as well as bullets. And all Americans learned how much could be gained when government agencies, scientists, and universities worked together for common goals. Roosevelt had understood this long before the war ended. He asked Vannevar Bush to study how the federal government could work with scientists and universities in peacetime. Bush offered a number of ideas to President Truman at the end of the war. He told the president that science was important to America's progress and safety. He called on the federal government to support scientific study and education. Professor Bush said that the nation's universities should be greatly strengthened. He called for the creation of a new government agency to provide money for science projects. Truman and Congress agreed with Vannevar Bush, and in the next few years, American research efforts expanded. In 1946, the Office of Naval Research was created to support basic science study in universities. In the same year, the government created the Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1950, it created the National Science Foundation to provide support to thousands of the nation's best scientists. In the years that followed, American science would grow beyond the wildest dreams of Vannevar Bush and other scientists of his time. Universities would add thousands of new students, along with new laboratories and research centers. By the middle of the 1960s, the federal government would spend more than $13 billion a year for research and development. And 500 new centers of higher learning would be created. All this investment would help make the United States the world leader in such fields as computer science, genetics, and space travel.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.